Yes, sir.
Well, when we talk about this, it kind of feels like when you talk about time, of like you run out of words very quickly when you talk about, well, before there was no time.
Yes.
There was nothing. So when you say, why is there something rather than nothing, you can only conceive of nothingness when you have something. You know, when you go, well, if nothing was there, then we wouldn't be asking the question. Like, by virtue of asking the question, you're acknowledging that the concept is hard to deal with, because if it wasn't there, then there's nothing to ask.
Like, this is down the road a little bit, but Lewis said the same thing. He said, if we didn't have any meaning, it'd be like creatures without eyes. You'd say, oh, it's dark, and you'd go,
okay.
No idea right. What dark is, you know, right. Dark light, whatever.
Right, the concept doesn't even exist. The concept of darkness doesn't even exist right. If you have no eyes.
Right.
So it's an interesting discussion, but when you try to back out of it, it's that, you know, that infinite regression kind of thing. You try to back out of it, and you run into a limit of, like, language and concept.
You start talking, if you have no eyes, you go, well, sometimes when I step outside, I feel heat.
Right.
But that's it. You know, so we're starting to talk in tertiary and quaternary experiential things that, you know, we don't even really fully grasp, right?
I mean, so, yes, I am also, to the point you made, one, I'm excited to talk eventually here about time, because now I do have an answer for you on that one. I think I have an answer on that one, so see if you find it compelling. On the basicality of this question, and can it be thought of conceptually, a great transition, here are the concepts that people put it into. Or here were the concepts that Leibniz put it into, and people have continued down this path since his time. When something exists, whether it's us, the universe, anything, he breaks it into two categories of existence. And what he says is basically this. He says everything, and here he means, you know, whether you've got a concept or you don't have a concept, whether it's a real, actual thing out there or whether it's merely a concept of the thing. So, you know, without getting, I don't want to get too far down the philosophy of it, because I don't think it's terribly useful personally, but you might say that this, you know, this phone or this camera is a thing, but that I have a concept of the camera which may or may not be accurate. So I make statements about the camera that may or may not be full and complete and accurate and all that kind of stuff, but that's the referent. The camera itself is the referent, and the statements I'm making about it are concepts that are mental constructs or something else, all that. So whether we're talking about the thing itself or whether we're talking about our concept of the thing, well, I'm talking about everything, or he's talking about everything. Everything that exists, and this is the beginning of an argument that he makes, has an explanation of its existence. And I'll stop there. There's more to it.
Tell me more about that.
All right. Of its existence. And what we mean by that, because remember, we're asking the philosophical questions. I mean, people have asked it up here. What exists? How did it all start? That was kind of the second thing that people wanted to know. We're not okay, philosophically, with just looking at something and being like, shrug. Okay, I guess that exists. I don't care where it came from. You know? That, in modern culture, this is the thing that gets me most. If someone wants to make a deposit into my bank account, they have to get my permission to do it. In fact, the bank seems to go through some difficult... I have tried the best I could to talk to everybody at the bank and say, listen, I want you to write it down and put it... If anybody wants to put money into my bank account, you let them. It's the taking money out that I want you to challenge. But by all means, put a giant catcher mitt out there and take any money that anybody will give you and put it in this bank account. But we want an explanation of where things come from, ourselves included, and this world included. And what Leibniz says is, okay, well, let's assume there's an explanation, or let's ask the question of, is there an explanation? And the reason he asks the question is what? Why does he think that there might be an explanation of everything?
This chaos versus cosmos idea?
Yeah, it seems to us very, very obvious from the whatever it is that we can sense that everything that we see has some sort of causal pathway to it. There's nothing in this room that didn't have an explanation, to our knowledge, of how it got here. You know, Lang brought this box in. I brought this iPad in. You brought your coffee in. You are here yourself because you drove here from your home and parked and all this stuff. All of these things have these causal trails to them. And what we're really asking is, Where's the other end of the trail? Where does it stop? And we all know where it might stop in our own lives. We have our parents, and that's when we were born, and maybe we could say, well, that's when I came into existence. Maybe, right? There are other questions. Some people believe in an immortal well of souls from which God draws. Some people believe that God makes the soul at that time. Some people don't believe in souls and think that you come into existence materially when this particular thing happens. Or ultimately, some people say it's all part of a space-matter universe, so you're no different. The fact that you're arranged in a certain way is no different than the fact that that the dirt is arranged in a certain way. No difference. So, but there's a point to which where you can talk about causality and where that cause comes from. And what we're really asking is, what is there a cause way at the beginning? And so if we know there's this causal principle, or in the principle anciently is known as the principle of sufficient reason, the principle of sufficient reason, what's the reason that this is here? What's the reason that this is at this place or exists at all? And if you think about things like science, you know, our kind of modern epistemology framework, our modern way of knowing things, is basically the scientific method. We have kind of been taught in our society that if it's not a scientific truth, it's a questionable truth. Well, the scientific method is founded on the principle of sufficient reason. There is no experiment. You'll never go to a paper and say, we smashed these protons together in the Large Hadron Collider, and we got these signals out of it, and we think that this is the Higgs boson, and then also we found this large particle over here. Now, that one didn't come from the proton collisions. That one just appeared out of nothing with no reason whatsoever. But we wanted to let you know that we found it. That paper does not get published because everybody's going to say, no, if there is a particle there, it came from somewhere. From whence did it come? Now, some people may say this was a fluctuation in the vacuum energy of blah, blah, blah. Or some people may say Timmy dropped his coffee into the collider at the same time, and that's where it came from. But ultimately, science itself is based on the idea of you look for causes. You look for sufficient reason for the data that you're seeing. Okay, so he goes further and says, everything that exists has an explanation of its existence. Either, and these are the terms, remember I told you there's only one concept to really grasp here. This is the concept. It's these two words. Either in the necessity, and this is the hard one, of its own nature, or in some external, what do we mean by external here? Cause. External cause means we don't allow things to be self-caused. You can't turn around and say, I'm here because I caused myself to be here. That is to say, I didn't exist beforehand, but in not existing, I called myself into existence and now I exist. We turn around and we laugh. Al's face is correctly depicting the reaction of that one, which is smiling incredulity.
It would be ase then, huh?
Right. Well, no, because ase, that goes back to point one, but don't jump ahead too far. Hold on one second. In the necessity of its own nature or in some external cause. So let's focus on the second one first, in some external cause, because I think we all understand this very intuitively. It's our normal experience. Everything that you see that exists in whatever form it exists has an external cause for that existence. Now, old philosophers broke causes into four types and all this other stuff, but don't worry about that. The question is, or more or less, does everything that you see here have some cause? The iPhone has a cause. Now, you may say, you know, the cause was Steve Jobs, or the cause was a manufacturing plant in China, or the cause was the metal. But the bottom line is kind of all of those together, but it's a set of things that caused that thing to be. Nobody turns around and says it popped into existence. Boom, there it is. We don't say that. We say that something caused it to happen. Those were all external causes. Necessity of its own nature is the hard thing to grasp. So this is, if you're not familiar with this kind of stuff, if you are familiar with this stuff, it's not necessarily terribly intuitive. It takes a little bit of thinking to think about it. But necessity of its own nature can refer to there are a couple classes of things that this goes into, but mostly, if you're not talking about theological constructs, this is numbers or laws or something like that. So as an example, the number 7 is an abstract object. So there are some people who believe that things like numbers or mathematical operations, in fact, Carl probably believes this. Tell me if you don't, sir. But might say something like this. It doesn't matter what world exists. It doesn't matter what world exists. The number 7, or the number 2, is always there. It always has to be that way. You can't change what 2 means. Two can't, in our universe, 2 means, you know, these two identical things together. There are these two things. If you count them, you get the number 2. In another universe, if you count these two things, you get the number 3. He'll say, no, you just miscounted. 2 is 2 no matter where you go. And so Platonists, or people who are realists about numbers, will say that abstract things like numbers, or maybe laws of logic, or maybe mathematical laws, that those things exist no matter what. They exist necessarily. And what we mean by a necessary truth is it's impossible that it not be that way.
So only in abstractions, though.
So, say again.
Only in abstractions, except for maybe one.
So the question is there anything that's... So in the philosophy world, they break objects. So objects can be things like a number 7. We think of object like a thing that you can put your hand on. But in philosophy, objects are whatever it is you're talking about. You can have two kinds. You can have concrete, and you can have abstract. So is justice a concrete or an abstract thing? An abstract thing. Are numbers abstract? Yes. Are people abstract or concrete? Concrete. So it doesn't, you know, concrete does seem to suggest material or physical or energy, mass, whatever. But the idea, when you differentiate, what do you mean by this? How do you differentiate? Excuse me. When you ask the question, how do you differentiate? Generally speaking, it seems like philosophers differentiate it by saying this one. Which one of these has causal power? If it has causal power, it can be part of a causal chain. That's concrete. If it can't, it's abstract. Now, maybe abstract things are caused, like my thought or your thoughts right now may be caused by my words. And the reaction of your minds and brains and whatnot, but they cannot themselves cause other things.
This goes down into like forms, right? Where they talk about the idea of a chair versus an actual chair.
Right. So not to get too far deep into that, but like Aristotle will talk about there are forms out there, and there are 4 ways you can have causes. You can have material causes, efficient causes, formal causes, and final causes. So these are all really just ways of looking at, like I said, the set of things that goes together to bring something into existence or to happen. Yes, sir?
Not to get too far afield, but I think it's relevant for us to consider, where do you put spiritual entities under the concrete abstract distinction?
Right. So here's the question to jump straight to what Carl's asking about. Minds or spirit or soul, concrete or abstract?
Yeah, concrete, but not physical.
So you're right in that minds are considered... If minds exist, philosophers will say it this way, if minds exist, then they are concrete. Why? If our differentiator is, do they cause things? Well, we all agree that our minds cause things. Our minds cause things in our brain to happen, and then we can lift our arm. Okay, so that it's part of a causal chain. So yes, minds are concrete. Numbers are abstract. Full disclosure, I don't believe that abstract objects exist in a real way. I think everything that exists is concrete, so the abstract objects that exist in our minds as products of our minds. And so they're not things in and of themselves. They are mind-dependent things, and therefore not things in and of themselves. So the number 7, I think, gets assigned to a certain concept. And the question of whether the concept is real or not, you know, I haven't made an argument for that one. I'm just telling you what I believe. I would have to go further to argue for that, because that is not, I don't know. Most mathematicians, when polled, are realists about numbers. They think that these numbers actually exist, that maybe before the universe existed, numbers existed. But some people will joke that position is called Platonism. Part of that position is called Platonism. They joke that they're Platonists during the week and anti-realists on the weekend. So there's a little bit of a tongue-in-cheek relationship here on these things. But the bottom line is, some people believe they're real, some people believe they're useful fictions. I happen to fall in the useful fiction camp. All right, so here we go back to our argument that Leibniz is laying out for us, starting to lay out for us. Everything that exists has an explanation of its existence, either in the necessity of its own nature, like numbers. You don't need a cause for seven if it actually exists. So forget me, pretend I'm wrong. Even I'll say, if numbers do exist, I will tell you they exist necessarily. If numbers do exist, they do exist necessarily. You can't change the definition of seven. You can't change what two is, those kinds of things. Two plus one will always equal three, no matter where you are, period. Now, if those are real things, then that's true necessarily. So those things would exist necessarily. The other thing that would exist necessarily that Kevin's been hinting at is possibly is God. Is the concept of God one of a being, a thing, a concrete object, maybe something like this, a concrete object that exists due to the necessity of its own nature? That is to say, now what did I say necessity means? It's impossible that it not be the case. It's impossible that it not be the case. I'll give you an example. This is ifs. So if you accept these if statements, if being married means that you are, if being a married man means that you have a wife, and I say Kevin is married, what is now necessarily true? I said, remember, those were if statements. Those may or may not be true, but if those were true, now what has to be the case? Kevin has a wife. So do you see how they follow? This is a deductive argument, and they follow necessarily. If being a married man means that you have a wife and Kevin is married, then Kevin has a wife. Now, you might object to one of the premises and say, being a married man doesn't mean you have a wife. In today's culture, it might mean you have a husband. So I'm saying that one is false. So that's a deductive argument that you can challenge the premises. But let's take another one, an easier one, the normal one that gets brought up. Yeah, and then we'll get then Kevin. This is the one that's always brought up in philosophy classes. Men are mortal. Socrates is a man. Therefore, Socrates is mortal. So that's another deductive argument that the conclusion follows necessarily from the premises. That is to say, if the premises are true, it has to be the case. It's true by necessity. It cannot be otherwise that the conclusion results.
Based on this construct of understanding, the incarnation is almost incomprehensible.
Way too far down the path, so contain your philosophical, you're going too fast for us. So hold on 1 second on that one, because that brings in too many other issues that I don't want to confuse it at this time. But you're right, and it's one of the reasons that doctrine is the least, I think the second least defined doctrine in Christianity. So you're absolutely right, but hold on to that one, because those would be deep waters. All right, I saw another hand up. I missed it. Yes, sir.
I guess I was just trying to wrap my head around, are numbers contingent on minds?
If you're an anti-realist, yeah. So an anti-realist says they don't actually exist, then you might answer
but
yes.
But the Platonist would say the numbers just necessarily exist.
Right, and what the Platonist will say is something like this. The number seven exists. What happened was we discovered that's the case.
And so is the number seven just...
It's an abstract object, so you know you can't...
Where does it exist?
Yeah, right. Where does it exist is a good question, but you can ask the same question about minds, or you can ask the same question about laws of logic. You might say something like, well, the law of, you know, something cannot both be and not be at the same time. That's a contradiction, law of non-contradiction. That seems to always be the case. But even if there weren't minds, that would be the case, might argue the Platonist. Even if your mind doesn't exist, it can't both be the case that your mind exists and that it doesn't exist at the same time. So they're going to say that these laws exist in Plato's mind. It was this ideal world that lay behind all other worlds. In other realist minds, they say that these are just abstract objects that exist necessarily. So they're always there. In the somewhat confusing at times possible world semantics, the way we talk about worlds as possible worlds, there is no possible world where the number seven doesn't exist. Or maybe a better way of saying it, there's no possible world where 2 + 2 doesn't equal 4. You cannot even conceive of a world. Build me a world where 2 + 2 does not equal 4. And the fact that we can't even conceive of that means that it's not, might mean that it's not possible. And so we would say there's no possible world where 2 plus 2 doesn't equal 4. So 2 plus 2 equals 4 is true necessarily. It's true in all possible worlds. It's true no matter what happens. It's impossible that it be false. So you're right, though. The anti-realist might turn around and say, well, nobody would have even said the word 2, the numeral 2, what the number 2 represents. That doesn't even mean anything unless there's a mind to conceive of it. But this is another set of arguments down the road. As long as you understand that some things might exist necessarily and some things might exist contingently, that's the point. So the real question is this world that you see right here, where you are right now, did this have to be this way? Is this world this way necessarily? What do you think? Why not?
Because it could have been infinity other ways.
Yeah, like what? Give me another way that this world right here
could have been 1 centimeter smaller in diameter.
Right. Skyler might not have walked in today, right? If you think that Skyler had to walk into this class and sit there and ask the questions he asked, then you might say that you think this world is necessary. But if you think that it's even possible that Skyler didn't come to class or asked a different question or wore a different shirt or whatever else, if you think any of that's possible, then what you don't think that this world is necessary. You think this world is contingent, and or at least the way the world is contingent. And so the real question that Leibniz is asking is this world seems to be contingent, because it seems that it's possible that this world didn't even exist at all. I mean, is it possible that the world we're in didn't exist at all? I think we would say, yeah, I can think how that might be possible. Lang's not here, Eric's not here, Carl's not here, we're all not here. This room isn't here. That's what it would look like. You know, the whole world wouldn't be here.
This may be going too far down the line too, but if it's true that that God knew the 25 of us or however many there are were going to be here today, does that mean that the 25 of us were going to, I mean, I don't know the right term,
yeah, right.
Necessary or contingent, so, or whatnot, but
a great question. I'll refer you back to, I think, a class that you were not here for where we talked about foreknowledge, divine foreknowledge. And the question is, does truly faultless foreknowledge imply necessity? And so we drew out the argument for and against that when I think we showed why foreknowledge is not causal. So it's not God's knowledge. The short answer is this. God's knowledge doesn't cause that to happen. It's that God infallibly knows that that will happen, and therefore that's what his knowledge is. So because you can imagine a world where he says, is it possible for God to say this? I'm going to make a world, and I'm going to intentionally shut my eyes so that I don't know what happens for the next 100 years. Can God do that? If the answer is yes, God has the power to do that, that he wants to do that, that that's logically consistent to do. And you say, okay, well, what happened in that 100 years? And then God rewinds the world and does it again. And this time he takes the blinders off that he put on himself and says, now I want to see in advance of what happens. And he sees it. The fact that he sees it doesn't cause it to happen. He's already set it off. He's already sustaining it. It happens. The fact that he sees it isn't causal. So that's kind of the argument.
The fact that he sustained it by the word of his power all the time, though, adds some complications to it, which is why I asked for Aristotelian causality to be brought up in that
Gotcha.
Session.
So I'll take a brief, because I'm very personally interested in this one, and I'm planning on writing something soon on this one. There's a debate in the literature now between Arthur Cunningham and William Hasker. Both of these are Hasker's a big name philosopher, Christian philosopher, who's an open theist. He thinks that God, it's not a lack of God's power that he can't know stuff, but Hasker thinks that it's logically impossible to know what people with free will do. He just thinks that it's one of those things that there are things God, quote unquote, can't do. God can't do things that are logically impossible. So God can't create a married bachelor. Maybe the Bible says things like that. God can't lie. It's logically impossible for a perfect being to lie, that kind of thing. So that doesn't take away from God's power. God can do anything that's logically possible at all. But Hasker just believes that, as an open theist, that it's logically impossible to know what people with free will do. Cunningham's on the other side and says, no, we can have free will and God can know everything that we're going to do. He believes, I think, in middle knowledge, but I'm not sure. The argument that they're having is, they say this, and forgive me the digression, if you can tune out if this doesn't interest you. I guess you always have permission to do that anyway. If is it is it true to say it this way? God brings it about that Chris sat in this class today. Now, we all want to say, if God is all-powerful and sovereign, that God did bring it about that Chris came and sat in this class today. We say, well, that's basically the definition of the sovereignty of God. Of course, that's the case. The other question that you ask, though, is, let's give Chris free will. Did Chris choose to come into this class today? So yes. Okay, let's say that he did choose to do that. Okay, so did Chris bring it about at all that he came into this class? Well, we might say, yeah, he had something to do with it. They talk about all of this in terms that I think are wrong. They talk about, did God bring this about, or is it not the case that God brought this about, or how is it that God brought this about? I think that the statement, God brought it about, and let's pretend for this argument, sake of argument, that Chris does have free will. That's the presupposition that we're making here, is that Chris does have free will. Did God bring it about that Chris came to this class today? I see that as logically equivalent to the following statement. God solely and completely brought it about that Chris came into this class today. That statement's false.
Necessity.
Right. What happens here is God brought it about and Chris brought it about. So what you have to say is the result, Chris is sitting in this class today, is the result of two wills, both God and Chris, together. Now, it's not like Chris and God sat down and said, okay, what plan do we have for the 25th? What do you want to do? I think I want to do this. And they planned it. That's not what we're saying. But God, with foreknowledge, might have brought it about that these other things happened so that when Chris was presented with the choice, he knew that Chris would choose to come sit in class today.
Grudem calls that the two causalities, concurrence in systematic theology.
And for those who have sat in the other ones, or for those, it doesn't matter. The doctrine of the inspiration of Scripture is this doctrine. It's called confluence. It's not that God, to my knowledge, no major seminary teaches that when the Holy Spirit inspired biblical authors to write, that he was like a puppet master and that he took over and the guys were just writing and they didn't know, and you know, they had nothing to do with it. And we've gone over that. I refer to you in previous classes as why that's the case, why theologians think that's not the case. What they think instead is that God used people in a certain time by inspiration of the Holy Spirit to confluently, together with them, write so that everything that they end up writing is exactly what God wanted written. So it's not puppeteering, it's confluence. It's two wills working together, but one of them is clearly the more powerful will that has arranged everything so that it happens in this particular way. So I think the statement, God brings it about that a person with free will does X, is false. I think to make the statement true, you have to say God and person A bring it about that X happens. Brief digression, but thank you for that.
Is it useful to and when this discussion comes up, every time it comes up, my brain says, isn't it more useful to think of God as being capable of understanding every conceivable outcome? He knows all things, yes. But in order for things to happen with free will, this guy comes or this guy doesn't come today, no matter how that happens, he should have been in a car wreck, he shouldn't have been in a car wreck. He knows how to configure the world with an understanding of every conceivable outcome.
Yeah, I think you're right. The problem is it's so hard to get your mind around how many things you have to do. So the simple example I usually give, I'll burn through it this time, and then I'll give one step bigger for Lang's sake here to bring it up. Usually I pick on Skylar and Julia. Julia's Skylar's wife. I say that if I know Skylar, I don't know him terribly well, but I know him decently well. He's a former law enforcement professional in the Air Force. I know a little bit about his character, all this kind of thing. And Skylar is what we might call a stand-up guy. If I took this phone and I threw it at Julia, I know what's going to happen. Skylar is going to either step in the way or put his hand in the way and block it. And I usually add on, and then he's going to come and have a kinetic discussion with me shortly thereafter. So I would say, I can make Skylar block or catch my iPhone by throwing it at Julia. Do any of you think that I made Skylar do that? That Skylar had no choice in the matter, and that I, like a puppeteer, move Skylar around? No,
it depends on whether Skylar sold it or not.
Right. Yeah, assuming all the things that you would have to assume for this to work, right? So no, Skylar doesn't lose his free will because I know how he react and I poke him about it. So that doesn't make me God, that I can make him do something. It doesn't even make me powerful. All it means is that I understand a little bit about Skyler and about what will happen based on Skyler's character and abilities and all that other kind of stuff. Okay. Now imagine that I knew each of you so well, so well. And so I know Skyler a little bit. Imagine I know you so well, I know what you've been reading. I know what you've been posting on Facebook. I know what you even think in your minds. And I'm the ultimate mentalist, mind reader, psychic. I know everything that you're thinking. So maybe I'm sitting here and I hear Al saying, you know, in his mind, you know, this isn't making a lot of sense. What is he, why isn't he talking about contingency in the following way? And then I might say this. You know, I got to ask the question, what about if we thought about contingency in the following way? And knowing what I know about Al, that I know that Al will raise his hand and say, you know, I've been thinking about this for a while, because I know he's been thinking about this for a while, and all this other stuff. Did I make Al say that? Does Al have no choice? Or did I happen to know enough about Al that if I ask a certain question, I know that he will freely do something? Now, I might be wrong because I'm, you know, because I don't have all the knowledge, or maybe I can't think that fast. But imagine now that I'm super intelligent and I just don't make calculation mistakes. I could probably arrange this class in such a way that, knowing all of your minds, I could ask, there's a certain number of questions that I could ask that would cause you in some way to respond or to ask a question yourself. And then I could predict what questions you're going to ask, and I could arrange the class in such a way that exactly the questions I want to get asked by the people I want to ask them happen. But there might be no world in which I could sit here and talk about rocket fuel, and that, because nobody in here cares about rocket fuel, none of you would ask a question. So there's no way for me to talk about rocket fuel in such a way that it generates a question, other than talking about it for half an hour, somebody raises hands like, why are you talking about rocket fuel, you knucklehead? So there's some set of things that are possible in a world of free people with a certain amount of knowledge that I can, quote unquote, make happen in the same way that I make Skyler catch this phone when I throw it at his wife. But there's another set of things that can never happen. The person who believes in middle knowledge believes that God knows all that stuff, and that the reason the world works out exactly how he plans it to is because he took all that into consideration. He went bigger than this room. He went the whole, all of known existence, and that he does that with the whole world. People who believe in determinism say he doesn't have to bother doing that one. He's the one who's the causal force behind it all, and it, free will is an illusion. People who believe in kind of a middle view of that one say it's both this one and that one, but we don't understand how those two go together because our minds just can't grasp it. And then the open theist says, no, God can't know any of that, but because he's that smart, he's as smart as I was kind of telling you about, he knows the range of possibilities. So he basically plays zone defense, right? He sets things up in such a way that he contains it the whole time, but he couldn't tell you exactly what happens at some of these given moments, but he does know what happens at the end because he's sovereignly contained it all into what the end will be. So the open theist, the middle knowledge person, and the determinist, and the compatibilist all have different views. I refer to you some of our earlier classes on all those four topics for that one.
Really, if you break it down, it's how strong is God, and how does he, and in which ways does he act for this creation? That's it.
I would say yes. If I would clarify the first point by saying, what is it possible for God to know, and do people have free will? If you can answer those two questions, if you know for a fact which of those two questions, the answer to those two questions, you have one of the views turns out to be true. Boom, done. So those are the two key questions to answer there. What is possible for God to know? Do people have free will? Has he given man free will? If you know those two answers, then you know which one of those four views is right. The debate is about some combination of the two, and most people want to affirm free will. So usually the debate is about, what is it possible for God to know?
It's kind of funny that when people talk about free will, I think they mean something completely different. I mean, when you talk about free will, you're basically saying God can coerce you. And I say coerce in a pejorative sense, but I don't mean that. God can coerce you into pretty much doing anything.
I'll ask you to define coerce. This is totally off topic, but I love this topic, so I'll allow it.
I mean that God can channel you into exactly what, like you say rocket fuel and we're all bored with it, but there's definitely a universe in which God can grow you up to which you have a dying love for rocket fuel.
And okay.
You sit in this class and you're like, rocket fuel? Today?
Tell me more. This is it. Natural. Time
today
for a party.
Rocket fuel day.
So, part of what I'm saying is that might not be the case. It might be that there's no possible world in which Al gets excited by rocket fuel. It may be the case that that's true. We don't know. And that's why what's it possible for God to know kind of stuff. Or maybe that's what is the possibility when it comes to the range of potentials of a given mind or soul. Yes. But let's grant for a second that that's the case. Let's say that God can coerce you to do anything. I ask again the question of, did I coerce Skylar?
Yeah, you did.
Okay, if that's your definition of coerce. Well,
yeah, and it's not a good term. What I'm saying is that you can force movements from other people,
right,
or force reactions from other people based on a consistent knowledge of how they've acted in the past.
But in doing so, here's what I would argue, and I think that this is, gosh, we are getting far afield here, but this is a good one. Yeah, we will hit this one later in more depth, so if this doesn't satisfy you, don't worry about it. I'll tell you what I think that I really did with Skylar by doing that. When I throw this phone at Julia, I expose to the world, or at least to this classroom, some of who Skylar is. You will see by me throwing this phone, not that Skylar mechanically did something. What you're going to say is a few things. One, you're going to see that he's a protector. Two, you're going to see that he's brave. He doesn't care about the damage that this phone, which I guess get lighter and lighter every time. It's still pretty hefty. I feel like you could fling this one and do a little bit of damage.
Look what Odd Job did with the hat.
There you go, Odd Job. I forgot. You're dating yourself, sir.
I know. This,
you're going to see that he's brave. You're going to see that he's loyal. You're going to see that he will have a heart for justice. How are you going to see that one? It'll be in the follow-on actions that he will likely take. Right? So I have not created in Skylar justice and loyalty and thoughts about those things. What I have done, rather, is expose the character that he already has. Now, the thing about us in here is that for those who are parents and who have seen it, you know that your kids come with some things. And you know that you can hone some of those, and you can blunt other ones on them, and you can develop them in things. But you'll have known about your kids that if you've got a kid who's very, very specific and wants everything in the right order, and all that kind of stuff, you can't beat that out of them. They will always have some of that there. Now, you can give them other things. You can teach them to mitigate some of that if you think it's excessive or something. But at the end of the day, there's something there already, apparently, maybe. This is nature versus nurture stuff. But the bottom line is, talking about me, I'm not the one who caused those things to happen in Skylar. The question is, did God give those things to Skylar in the first place, and Skylar has no choice about exercising them? At the end of the day, I don't think that any of us intuitively believe that. I don't think that anybody believes that you've got nothing to do with whether you choose right or wrong. And that's the part that I'll push off for another time, because that's a very long and contentious discussion. But, all right, good points. Let's come back to this for a second so that we get this done in this class, because it's important that we get at least this point covered. Back to necessity of its necessity, things that have to be that way. Everything that exists, everything out there, this is the deepest philosophical question. We are down at the plane level here. Why does this plane exist at all? Why does anything exist rather than nothing? And so Leibniz starts to make an argument, and he says everything that exists has an explanation of its existence, either in the necessity of its own nature, it had to exist, like numbers, if you think numbers have to exist, or God, if you think God has to exist, or in some external cause. The universe, and maybe here's this one, we'll say the universe, maybe we can say we, the universe exists, and then based on that much, what do we have to argue? If everything's got an explanation of its own nature, either in the explanation of its existence, either in necessity of its own nature or in some external cause, and the universe exists, then that means the universe has an explanation. All right, now we have two choices. The universe could be explained because it's of the necessity of its own nature. It had to be that way, period. It has to be that way. But we just talked about it. The universe doesn't have to be this way. In fact, it sounds to us like the universe didn't have to exist at all. That means the universe is contingent. It is not necessary. And by this argument, if it's not this one, it has to be this one. So it depends on whether you like these premises. So I'll pull it up where it's written out in English and not my chicken scratch. Here's the argument. Every existing thing has an explanation of its existence, either a necessity of its own nature or an external cause. Forget two, because this is a later formulation of it for now, but the universe exists, and therefore the universe has an explanation. Now the question is, what's the explanation? This is the actual final form of the argument. And we'll get into why some of the, like, which premise do you think is the least in this version of it? So take a second to read it, and then tell me of 1, 2, and 3, which are the premises, and 4 is the conclusion. Which of those do you think is the weakest premise? Which one would you attack? Which one would you say is not certain? Yeah, so everybody attacks number 2.
I'd say 3.
That the universe exists?
Yeah.
Okay, I think there are people who will deny the universe exists, but if the universe just means whatever it is that does exist. So let's say stars and planets and galaxies are illusions, and you're a solipsist, and you're the only thing that exists, now the universe is you. So if you so the question is, does something exist? If the answer is something exists, then yes, we're calling that something the universe. But thank you for being the exception to the rule on that one. Okay, so 2 is the one that people are going to want to challenge, because it seems like a launch into absolutely nowhere.
It seems like a complete concept.
Yeah, it comes right out of left field. So there is some argumentation that goes into 2, and here's what that argumentation is. We'll start into it this time. We'll go more into it next time, in 2 weeks. Remember what I said were the categories of things, Scott. The categories of things that could be an explanation. Either it's the necessity of its own nature or an external cause. Well, if the universe refers to everything that exists, and here we're talking about things that exist contingently, it would appear, then, or let's say everything that exists, does this universe exist by the necessity of its own nature? No. It's contingent, so it has an external cause. What are the possibilities for the external causes? Well, here they are. Everything that we can conceive of, all of the possibilities that we know of out there, are either abstract objects or concrete objects. Now, if you're talking about abstract objects and concrete objects that do not depend on the universe for their existence, what are there? There is only a necessary being, a being that has to exist, or there are necessary things, abstract objects. But what is the definition of an abstract object? What's a differentiator? Something that doesn't cause anything. It can't cause anything. They're causally effete. They're ineffective to cause things. So no possible abstract object could be the external cause for the universe. The only thing left in the whole category set of things that exist necessarily and are causal is something like God. And the something like God comes from this idea of a necessary being, a being that has to exist. Okay, so there's another way of looking at it that people will say stuff like that most atheists who would look at this and say, that seems like a non sequitur, you're coming out from left field. And we'll go into this more next time and explain it more next time too. But they might say something like this. They would be happy to agree with the following premise. If God does not exist, then the universe does not have an explanation. So most atheists will say things like that. Carl Sagan, the universe is a brute fact. It's a brute reality. It just is, and there's nothing more to it. He didn't say it in those words, but something like that. Atheists will frequently affirm, and I'm not saying this has to be this way, but some atheists will frequently affirm, that if God does not exist, then the universe does not have an explanation. What's a logically equivalent statement to that one? If God does not exist, then the universe has an explanation. So let's take it this way. If the universe has an explanation, then God exists. So this is a contraposition. This is just a logical rule. So basically the statement, if God does not exist and the universe doesn't have an explanation, is in fact logically equivalent to if the universe does have an explanation, then God exists. Now that's not a necessary That's not taken deductively. I'm just saying those are logically equivalent. So if you happen to be an atheist that says, yeah, I'm happy to say if God if God does not exist, then the universe has no explanation, then you have basically agreed with premise two. And if you've agreed with premise two, and everybody agrees with premise one, and everybody agrees with premise three, then you're stuck with premise four. So the power of this argument is, one of the powerful things about this argument is, it ought to be compelling to atheists who believe that if the universe, if God does not exist, then the universe does not have an explanation. It ought to be compelling. It turns out maybe not to be, for reasons that are different than whether it's logically true or not.
Most atheists I know simply say, we just haven't figured it out yet.
We haven't figured it out yet.
Just like people didn't understand about oxygen and air and gravity and this and that. And yeah, it's just a question of science just hasn't figured it out yet.
Right.
But now, so they'll say, yeah, it's not God, but there's a scientific reason, we just haven't gotten there yet.
Now, I'm aware that we're kind of constructing a straw man here, but he's right. If you're still going to talk about atheists in the main...
I talked to them, that's the argument.
And let's say that data set was representative, okay? Too small to be representative of all atheists. Right. But let's pretend for a second that's correct, that that's what most atheists believe. Then most atheists are committing some logical short steps here. And the problem, one of the things that they're failing to recognize is none of these truths right here are scientific. None of this is accessible to science. These are all metaphysical statements. And science cannot ever rule on them. It's not science will eventually get there. It is impossible for science ever to get there because science is based on some axioms. And one of the axioms it's based on is principle of sufficient reason. That's inaccessible. You can't prove that scientifically. So you have to assume that. You have to look for a cause. You wouldn't even be doing science if you didn't do so. So the problem for the lay atheist, the common atheist, there are other sophisticated atheists, by the way, that don't make this argument. But for the common atheist that does, if you take them at their word, we don't know this one, it's just going to come up eventually. It doesn't have to be, you know, you don't have to, there doesn't have to be a cause for it. It could be a brute fact. That, if you actually apply that one anywhere, all the way down, it destroys science. You can't do science. Because what you're going to say is brute facts are things that just exist. They just happen. They don't need explanation. If you're going to deny premise one, as an example, if you're going to deny premise one, you're done with science. You can't do science at all. If you're going to deny premise two, you've probably taken away what you usually state about the universe, which is the universe is just a brute fact. And by the way, this works also if the universe is eternal. The universe can be eternal, and this argument still works. Why? Because even though it's eternal, that doesn't mean it's necessary. It just happens to be eternal. It's eternal, but not necessary. Yes, sir?
Why can't it just be 1, 3, therefore the explanation of the universe is that it is the necessity of its own nature?
Because you would have to believe that the universe has to exist exactly this way.
No, not exactly this way.
Okay.
The universe has to exist for philosophy to exist, for science to exist, for any of these discussions to happen, the universe has to exist. I'm not seeing the logical flaw in that.
How about if I say, what about a necessary being? I'm going to put a necessary godlike being out there. Now can philosophy exist? And the universe doesn't?
No.
So God has to create the universe? Now, suppose this is an if, but just imagine a possible world where it's just God. That there's a necessary being, that necessary being has to exist. Let's just say that's the case.
There's no philosophy if there's just God.
God can't do philosophy?
No. Why not? God has no need of philosophy.
He may not have any need of it, but can he do it?
No.
Can
it's
God...
logically inconsistent for God to have deep philosophical thoughts about nothingness.
Can God say, I think, therefore I am?
But there's not nothing, there's three persons.
Well, forget Trinity for a second, but let's just let it be one God. No other persons, just one God. Can God say, I think, therefore I am?
That's what a corner feels like. That's what a corner feels like.
Chris is my brother, and we occasionally have some logical interaction.
I mean, I guess God can reach the same philosophical conclusion Descartes does,
yes.
But... what else is he thinking about?
He can contemplate himself.
The ultimate solipsis?
Yeah, right. The ultimate solipsis, right. Could God do this? Could God say, I'm going to contemplate building five universes out there. I'm going to think about which of them are morally, aesthetically, ethically, engineering-wise, better. I'm going to rank these in order. Now, he hasn't created a universe. There's not out there. But now he's asking philosophical questions about that which might be. So can God do that?
So philosophy supersedes God.
No, I'm not. I'm saying God would have to. What we're talking about, what God's doing.
Walking down that path, though.
Well, what I'm saying is God is the actor, and the action is what we call philosophy. Or the thinker, and the thinking is what we would call philosophy, or what God might call philosophy.
But why would God have to think about it?
So that gets into another thing. I don't think
he already knows everything. Yeah. So why does he have to think?
So what the way that I are? Wow, here we go. my own personal view, stepping out of this one, is not a lot of what we talk about in here. But Aristotle's view is not rest in Bible Church's view. Okay, so I think we understand it's not rest in Bible.
By the way, this could be our version, so throwing phones at you.
Oh yeah, that's good. Throw all the phones you wish. I will get his. You're caught. Yeah, this is called poking the bear. Yeah, right. Absolutely. The bear's gonna start swiping.
It's like Spencer, watch this. Ask God this.
Ask God this question. That's correct. You got me on that one. This is just one guy personally. I believe that God, as He is, you brought up the term ase, by Himself with no universe. I actually happen to believe that if He were not going to create a universe, okay, this is not the real world. But if He were not going to create a universe, He would be one person. So let's just talk about that one person for 1 second. So if He were not going to create a universe eventually, then He would be one person. That one person...
Eventually. So introduce time into this.
Yeah, absolutely. Time is going... And the answer to the questions that you and I have talked about some in the past, I think, lie in the nature of time and how it grounds itself in who God is. I do think, by the way, that God... Now let me back up 1 second and say, I do think that God is... and has been from eternity a Trinity.
Yes.
But what I'm saying is, I think that there are some dependencies there that I won't outline.
If God was one person, He would never create a universe. We can say that.
Yeah, or that's another way of saying it. Logically equivalent point. If you're one person, then that would mean He would never create a universe. But this is my own view, so I haven't justified any of this. I'm just telling you where I come from on this one. And your question, restate your question, because I'm going to weave what I just said into your question.
Yeah, why does He have to think? To Skylar's point, He would just... No, you wouldn't have to ponder whether or not He should or shouldn't or how He would do it.
Okay.
Because it would just be...
Because what He's talking about here is the way that we think. We think things like A. A implies B. Well, if A implies B, what about B? Well, B implies C. So if A implies B and B implies B is C, then A implies C. And we do this sequentially, linearly. I don't think that God's consciousness that exists... outside the universe, without the universe, ase, the God person, the person of the Father, in my opinion, I don't think He thinks sequentially. I think He knows everything simultaneously. There's no time has to go by for God to realize anything. There is no aha moment for God, right? He knows it all. So He's already got the plan. So in fact, in God's mind, so to speak, are all the possible universes He would create. And he doesn't have to do philosophy to think about them. He just knows, in the same way that He knows what the possibilities are, which is the quote-unquote right universe or the one that He wants to create. What I think happens is when He does start time, I think that that's when He begets the Word. I think that's when the Son is begotten, so to speak, initially. And that the mind of the Son does endure through time. So I think that the Father's mind is not in time. I think it is atemporal. I think the Son's mind is temporal. Now, I have made no argument for that. We will do that on the doctrine of the Trinity. But in answer to your question, I think that God can have all these thoughts simultaneously, even if you don't believe that. I'm just telling you what I believe. But even if you don't believe that, I think you can still affirm God knows everything simultaneously. What I think you'll have some difficulty coming into, one of the reasons I hold that view, is experiential knowledge. God doesn't know exactly what it's like to be on the cross if He hasn't been on the cross. He can know things about it externally, but He doesn't have the experiential knowledge of it unless He has the experience of these things. Later, we'll get into that kind of stuff. They've cracked the door earlier.
Unless you disagree, you might also say your thoughts on the Word existing eternally as well.
Yes.
So that you don't go on heresy alert.
Yeah, well, I've been on heresy alert for a long time. Existing eternally means exist. There is no time T that God did not exist. So I think it's the case that there is no time T that the Son did not exist. I think there is no time T that the Holy Spirit did not exist. There is no time when the statement, the Holy Spirit exists, the Son exists, is false. So for that reason, I think they're all eternal.
Because I think you said when God created time, the Word was begotten.
Yeah, so I actually think the time was created when the Son kind of steps away from the consciousness of the Father. We'll get into that later, but thank you for the clarification. Our time period. Time period.
To further your point, to say that God couldn't create the universe, I would say God couldn't create the universe in the way that it is right now.
Yeah.
Because he would create slaves rather than objects of his love.
So doctrine of man, we'll talk about that one a lot here.
To say that like God is love now becomes like this really, really, really deep philosophical statement.
And if you take nothing else away from this class, always take the God is love as a deep philosophical statement away, because that's my favorite one out there. All right, in the last 4 minutes, let me just outline this a little bit and then say, let's think about this over the next 2 weeks. Do a little bit of your own research on necessity and contingency, and I'm going to spend the last 4 minutes telling you why you should bother getting into this abstract philosophical construct. Every argument for God's existence, every argument for God's existence, is going to be dependent on what you think about necessity and contingency. Cosmological arguments, the universe exists, it is basically going to point to kind of a cause of the universe, an external cause. An ontological argument goes right to this stuff. Teleological arguments, I see a designer in it all. There has to be this implied design in it. All these things are going to depend on whether you think that the universe can exist necessarily. Now, Skylar's brought up an interesting point. Maybe the universe... We didn't finish our discussion. This was a good discussion. I'm sorry that we didn't finish it. Maybe we can take it up next time. But Skylar's point was this. Maybe the universe didn't have to be this way exactly. Maybe... Skylar didn't have to walk in today, but a universe has to exist. Maybe we say it that way. Okay, now the question then doesn't go, the differentiator isn't, did the universe have to be this way? The question is this, did the universe have to exist? Did the universe have to exist? What's the argument for why this universe as we see it, or not even as we see it, the concept of a universe, space-time, matter and energy, or sets of contingent things. Why do sets of contingent things have to exist? Things that might not otherwise be. And the point is this. If you're going to call it contingent, if you're going to say it didn't have to exist, you've already answered the question. By labeling it contingent, you've already said it's not necessary.
But if I'm saying in order to have the discussion, the universe is a prerequisite, then I'm not saying it's contingent.
Okay, but the discussion would be contingent.
No, you're putting... What I'm saying comes later, you're saying comes first. I'm saying to have the philosophy and to have the discussion and to even ask the question is contingent on the universe being there. That seems to... It takes God out of the equation, and I'm trying to see why that is logically inconsistent, and I don't.
So I think if I understood your question rightly, what you're saying is to even ask the question... The universe has to exist. Is that correct? Okay.
For us to be here,
the universe has to
exist. For the question to be asked by beings with minds.
Yes.
The universe has to exist.
Unless God exists.
Unless God exists.
Okay. So what we can say is this. How do you know it's the case that God doesn't exist? So there are two possibilities. Here's the answer to your question. It might not be satisfying, but this should be the answer. There's two possibilities. So the universe exists, and universe plus God exists. Okay? And you're saying in order for this discussion to happen, it has to be the case that this is true.
No, I'm saying universe existing without God is also logically consistent.
Oops. Why can this not be the case? Right.
No. I'm not saying it can't be the case.
What about
this? I'm saying they're both logically consistent.
Okay. Is it possible that the universe exists?
Is it possible that the universe exists, period?
With no God. Okay. Is it possible that God exists with no universe?
Yes.
Okay. Is God a contingent thing? Is it possible, based on what we're talking about, that God cannot exist? Well, if a God is actually a necessary being... if God is a necessary being, is it possible that he doesn't exist? The answer,
say that again.
If God is a necessary being, is it possible that he fails to exist? Right.
You said if God is a necessary being, is God necessary? Yes.
So here's the point then. If the universe exists and God's a necessary being, then God exists here too. So of our two options, you've got God existing on both sides. You've got a universe existing, and you've got another one where the universe doesn't exist. So these are the two possibilities. Is it possible for just God to exist and the question to be asked?
No. I don't think it is.
Why not?
Because then you're back to the question of God and philosophy.
So do you think God... So you said earlier you do think God can think, I think, therefore I am.
I think you're being disingenuous in your...
Well, I don't mean to be. Right.
I think you're being disingenuous in your argument.
I think that the answer to your question is this. It is either the case that the universe exists or does not exist. It's either and we're saying if God exists necessarily, it's always the case that God exists. In order to even have the discussion...
You're going back to the if God exists, then God exists argument. That if God can exist, then God does exist.
Well, this is what the argument from contingency... Leibniz's argument from contingency says is we seem to know about the universe is that it is contingent, is that it didn't have to exist.
I think going back to what you were saying earlier too is that most atheists would say, we have contingencies, but it goes so far back we can't find the original contingency. But in reality, what we have to say is like that original contingency has to be so big. We're not talking about like, well, a tree fell down in the forest, you know.
Right.
We're talking about like, that was the first act, you know, that a tree fell in the forest. Or...
So don't worry about this. We're well past time. We will. Are you going to be? Can you possibly be here in 2 weeks? Okay, probably.
Probably.
And if God so wills. Okay. Well, let's pick up exactly right here because this is a very good point and it'll lead us into where we're going next. And so, arm yourself as best you can over the next 2 weeks to take up the mantle that you have picked up here, because it's a good one, and if we can answer this one, then it'll be good. All right, thank you all very much for your time and attention. We look forward to seeing you, not next week, but the following week. Happy 4th of July. God be with you.
Thanks, Scott.
Yes, sir.